Questions? So we're 1 week before the exam. Help session some point. I still have overwhelmed by the amount of homework I've had to grade. Believe it or not, Pat, you've turned in
the most.
Okay, so the dentist is coming. Be scared. Be very scared. Questions? Well, so we're working our way up from one particle in one dimension to one particle in three dimensions. And so what comes next is to have several particles. And just like in 191, the kinetic energy splits into the kind of kinetic energy of the center of mass and the kinetic energy relative to the center of mass. And it looks kind of totally different because kinetic energy has to do with these derivatives. But with a little bit of calculus, we can show that this thing, which I hope you see is the kinetic energy of two particles, can be written as derivatives with respect to center of mass coordinates and derivatives with respect to relative coordinates. So the reduced mass turns out to be the thing that's kind of equivalent to the mass of any single particle. Frequently it's the case that the energy doesn't depend on the location of the center of mass. That is to say, you have translation invariance. The system here is the same as the system there. And under those circumstances, the corresponding momentum is going to be conserved, right? That's a result from mechanics. If a coordinate doesn't occur in the Lagrangian like the center of mass coordinate, then the corresponding momentum is going to be conserved. And the same sort of thing is going to apply here. If the potential energy doesn't depend on the center of mass, then the only contribution to the center of mass will be this kinetic energy term. And that's a real easy Hamiltonian to solve, the free particle. So we have that for our center of mass coordinate and the corresponding center of mass energy, and then we have to solve the relative Hamiltonian. So in the case of the hydrogen atom, the reduced mass is basically the mass of the electron. The center of mass energy would be the energy of the whole system moving through space. Mostly what we would have is exactly what we had before, except with mu replacing the mass of the electron. So n equals 2 is way easier than n equals 3 or n equals any particular number. But there are lots of things that have more than two particles in them. So we have to make some progress on that direction. What is often the case is we have assemblages of identical particles. Two electrons are totally indistinguishable, but a muon and an electron are distinguishable. They are in fact different. By definition, what we mean by identical particles is they have exactly the same contributions in the Hamiltonian. So if we exchange the coordinates of any two identical particles, the Hamiltonian is unchanged, which is to say that the exchange operator P commutes with a Hamiltonian, which means that the eigenfunctions are going to also be eigenfunctions of the parity operator, and since parity squared is nothing, the eigenvalues have to be either plus or minus 1, so a state either has to be symmetric or antisymmetric under exchange. Symmetric or antisymmetric under exchange are a lot of syllables. Parity has a definite meaning, which we haven't exactly run into yet. But it also has the same property of being plus or minus 1. So sometimes people talk about exchange parity or just parity. So be a little bit careful. I'm sure the book is careful, but it's an awful lot of syllables to say here. So I may slip into some abbreviated form of saying symmetric or antisymmetric under exchange. So from relativistic quantum mechanics, you can show that there are exactly two possibilities. That might be an oversimplification. Certainly two common possibilities. Fermions are so-called half-integer spins, that is to say, cases where the spin is like 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, an integer plus a half. And those are guaranteed to be antisymmetric under exchange of any two particles. So examples of fermions are pretty much anything you know about. Maybe slight overstatement. Protons, electrons, neutrons, quarks, lots of nuclei like carbon-13 or oxygen-17. We could even think about elephants having spin 1/2. Just depends on whether they have an even or an odd number of electrons and protons and neutrons making them up. What's, of course, different about elephants compared to electrons is you can spin the elephant fast or slow. You can change its spin, whereas we don't seem to be able to change the spin of an electron. Bosons have integer spin and they're symmetric under exchange, and the most common examples are a little bit special, the so-called gauge bosons like light, but alpha particles, pions that you met in 370, recently Nobel Higgs particle, the deuterium nucleus, all those are examples of integer spin particles. Pretty frequently, the wave function is a product wave function between space and spin, and that means we can kind of mix match the space spin exchange parity to get the proper value. So in a case like this, the spin part is antisymmetric under exchange. So if we're talking about a boson, the spatial part better be symmetric under exchange. If this were a fermion, then the spatial part better be symmetric under exchange. Did I say that right? So if it's a boson, F better be antisymmetric under exchange, so that -1 × -1 is +1. If it's a fermion, then F better be symmetric under exchange, so that overall exchange produces a -1. Questions? Well, two things that were in my notes, but I don't think quite made it to class. How do we make things that, so it's pretty easy to make things of two things that are symmetric or antisymmetric under exchange, right? Just by putting a plus sign or a minus sign there. But if you had three things or five things or 100 things, how would you make something that was antisymmetric under exchange or symmetric under exchange? And Slater's a famous dead American physicist, came up with the easy solution. It's to use the determinant. The determinant is also fully antisymmetric under exchange. So if I make a wave function that is f of r1, f of r2, f of r3, g of r1, g of r2, g of r3, h of r1, h of r2, h of r3, and I take the determinant of it, I will get something that is fully antisymmetric under exchange of R1 and R2 and R3. To make something that's symmetric under exchange, all I have to do is ignore the signs that I would get from the determinant. Right? So instead of having some plus signs and some minus signs in the determinant, just use the plus signs. Sometimes it's called the permanent, but not by anybody I want to share bread with. The case of n equals 2 is also a little bit special, because if we have identical particles, then what particle exchange does is it sets the relative coordinate to minus the relative coordinate. And the center of mass coordinate, since they're equal masses, it's just the average position of the two particles, and so it doesn't change under exchange. So then the exchange parity is all in the relative function, whether it is even or odd in exactly the normal mathematical sense. Questions? Well, so lots of problems in physics have to do with systems where, you know, n might be 100 or something like that, and we have lots of interact. So that's, I mean, that 100 is a lot different from 10 to the 23rd, so maybe I should be careful about calling that lots, but a good number of particles, and we're interested in solving for what the energies are. And kind of the standard examples are atoms, right? So there we might have Z electrons that are orbiting around a nucleus. Nuclear physics, right? So we might have, say, an oxygen nucleus, which has 8 protons and 8 neutrons. They're swimming around each other, interacting in funny ways. We have particle physics, where we have a proton, which consists of 3 quarks that are swimming around each other. And we're interested in solving for what these, you know, for what the energies, which is to say mass when we're talking about particle physics, what the energies are of the corresponding eigenstates. And it's not easy, is I guess the right word. There are an infinite number of complications. But luckily, you can go pretty far. You can take baby steps, is I guess maybe the best word, in understanding what these energies are based on simpler sort of considerations. And we could use any one of these as our examples. That is to say, all we're doing is trying to figure out what the energies are under all situations. But for particle physics, the quarks are really moving relativistically, so we need relativistic quantum mechanics. And the force law between the quarks, the so-called color force, is pretty complicated. For nuclei, typically people think about nuclei in the approximation that protons and neutrons are distinct particles as opposed to being bags of quarks. And so we have some sort of effective nuclear force that's left over from the color force. And it's pretty complicated, but and it's also it's moderately relativistic. So typically in these classes we deal with atoms as our moderately complicated system to talk about. It has lots of advantages. We know exactly what the force law is between electrons, right? It's just electrostatic interaction, maybe some magnetic effects. It's historically correct, that is to say the first things that people worked on were atoms. It turns out that you can measure atomic energy levels pretty easily to 5-6 digits. So we can get pretty accurate values, experimental values for these energy levels. And so we can compare the results of our calculations to experiment. Now, kind of the unfortunate side effect of any of these is that these are in some sense baby steps. If we wanted to do these things right, it would become pretty complicated pretty fast. So the kind of first person who dealt with finding the energy levels of atoms was Hartree. And you might remember that he's the guy who, just as we have Bohr radius, we have a Hartree energy, which is 27.2, that is to say twice 13.6 electron volts. And what Hartree came up with is, as far as I can tell, he did this just kind of qualitatively as opposed to kind of proving it mathematically. If we think about an atom, we've got, of course, our central charged particle, but we've got this cloud of surviving electrons. So the electric field at any particular point is going to depend not only on the central charge, but also on all of these shielding electrons. If we look at an isolated electron that's far away from the cloud, then this thing here is only going to have a net charge of plus one, right? Because if we're thinking about a neutral atom, because all of the internal electrons are going to be canceling the charge on the proton. And it's probably at least approximately spherically symmetric. So, I mean, we could use Coulomb's law for that interaction. So if we think about it, the potential is going to go kind of like 1 over r when we are far from it, and it's going to go like z over r when we are close to the nucleus, and it's going to kind of interpolate between the two possibilities. And the interpolation is going to depend on exactly what the cloud of electrons looks like. And the cloud of electrons depends on the solutions to Schrodinger's equation. To solve Schrodinger equations, I need to know what that potential is. So we have kind of a dog biting its own tail problem. And the solution to a lot of those sorts of problems is just to start and continue until you get tired. And that's what Hartree did. So he starts out with the hydrogen atom wave functions that we know and love. He calculates the cloud density, calculates what the electrostatic potential is as a result of that cloud, and then solves Schrodinger's equation again with that new potential. He gets new wave functions, which lead to a new charge density, which leads to a new potential, which leads to new wave functions. And you hope that after a while, things converge, that the wave functions you get are the same as the ones you got last time. And so this is sometimes called self-consistent. And this kind of makes sense physically. It turns out it's not exactly mathematically correct, and Falk is the guy who did it. Fully correctly, and so usually this game is called Hartree-Fock theory, and it's standard practice in terms of atoms and nuclei in terms of figuring out the results. And we could write some Mathematica code that would do this, but I'm not sure that there would be a lot to be learned from it, because I think the description makes it clear what's going on. It's just kind of a mess to carry this out. And it's amazing to me that Hartree did all of this, I don't know, circa 1930, without benefit of computers. So presumably he was using, you know, one of those hand crank calculators in order to crank out these self-consistent solutions. But we can get a pretty good idea about how this is going to work in terms of kind of baby steps just by thinking about what these orbits are like. So if we look at something like an S orbit, which you remember has a small amount of angular momentum, it's going to be penetrating that cloud. It's going to be experiencing a greater electric field than it would otherwise. And in particular, if we compare it to an orbit that has high angular momentum, so it has the same semi-major axis, but is circular as opposed to elongated, it's going to be mostly outside of that negatively charged cloud, and so it's mostly going to be experiencing the smaller potential. So what we had in the H atom, if we're thinking about, say, n equals 3, we had 3s, 3p, 3d, all as exactly the same energy, because it just depended on the 3. It just depended on the principal quantum number. But as soon as we start adding these sorts of considerations, our guess is that these states are going to become tilted, that the 3s state is going to lie below the 3p state, and that's going to lie below the 3d state. Okay? Does that make qualitative sense? As much as anything in the class. Okay, so what I've done online and kind of what the textbook does is to reinforce this general picture is to do a particular calculation with the simplest possible atom, helium. So the ground state of helium, we're going to put both electrons in the 1s orbit. So in terms of the wave function, and let me kind of use the abbreviation 1s for that whole ugly radial wave function. So I'm going to have 1s of r1 and 1s of r2. So that's symmetric under exchange. So I better pair it with something that is anti-symmetric under exchange. And then I've got a perfectly good state for a couple of fermions. And we know, we have found that this thing corresponds to total spin zero. And this thing is a combination of two things that have no angular momentum. So this is going to have net angular momentum zero. And so these states are classified typically in the LS or the Russell-Saunders. Depends whether you want to name some famous dead physicists or remind yourself of what's involved, L and S. So confusingly, it's either called LS or RS, where the S is different in those two cases. The typical notation is we use the letter of the total angular momentum, and then we use the degeneracy of S. That is to say, we label this with 2 times the total spin plus 1. Sorry for this kind of less than perfect notation. And we put a subscript with the total value of total angular momentum. And obviously, 0 plus 0 is 0. So the total angular momentum is going to be 0 for that state. OK, so that's the ground state. What are the excited states going to look like? Well, we might leave one electron in the ground state and put the other electron in the excited state. I won't put an arrow just yet. So what I can do is I can make a symmetric function of these guys, right? So I can make a function that is 1s of R1, 2s of R2, plus 1s of R2, 2s of R1. And again, this notation means those ugly wave functions that we've been dealing, right? So some Laguerre polynomial times some YLM, etc. So that's symmetric under exchange, so I better pair it with something that is anti-symmetric under exchange. And that's another state, just like this one, that is singlet S0. Or I could do the same thing and make a state that is anti-symmetric under exchange of space, but is symmetric under spin. Right? So we know that there are 3 choices, right, to have something that has spin 1. There's that, and then there's the symmetric combination. So all of these guys are spin states that have total spin 1. So 2 times 1 plus 1 is 3, so this is going to be a triplet S state. And if I add spin 0 to spin 1, the total angular momentum is going to be 1. Okay, so I could also do the same thing with by putting an electron in a 2p state. I expect a priori that those 2p states are going to be higher by the argument we've given before. But we don't have to believe that, because I can, in fact, for any one of these states, I can calculate the expectation value of the total energy and see what I get. So this is kind of a junior version of doing this Hartree-Fock. Okay, so do the same thing, except do these things with 2p states, and the results will be a singlet p, or a triplet p state. Okay, so what are the facts? Right, so I have argued that we expect that the p states are going to be higher than the s states, but here, in fact, we've got the energy level diagram for helium. So the ground state, of course, is where we put both of the electrons in the 1s state. We have excited states where we move one of those electrons up to higher energies. And the little lines show us what all of the transitions are. And I guess this This old diagram here I wanted to give you for comparison, right? This is the simple story that we had in modern. And we're going to see all of these diagrams becoming more complex, like this one. So there are a couple of things that make this more complex, and that is you notice that there aren't lines that connect any possible sets of states. So some transitions are allowed and some transitions are quote-unquote forbidden. You remember I said that you shouldn't take forbidden literally, it just means that they take longer than the typical time it takes to take data. Very importantly here is this state here. The state that we've just discussed, that triplet S, notice that there are no lines leading from it. So that state will survive for a long time before it can decay by one of these forbidden reactions. So the existence of that state is what makes helium neon lasers work. We're putting energy into that state, and the only way that energy can escape, well, not the only way, the only fast way it can escape is by colliding with a neon and transferring its energy to the neon, which then causes the lasering of the neon. So long surviving states like this triplet state are important for things like lasers. Incidentally, this other diagram is just a blow-up of the kind of optically important transitions for these states. So the other thing you recognize, I hope, by looking at these values is, generally speaking, the triplet states are lower energy than the corresponding singlet states. And I think we touched briefly on why that was going to be the case. If we have a singlet state, then it's going to have to be married to a symmetric state. And a symmetric state is going to be extra big when R1 equals R2, when the electrons are sitting on top of each other. Whereas an anti-symmetric state is going to be married with a symmetric spin state, a triplet state. And so as a result, when R1 equals R2, this spatial wave function has to be zero. So the probability of the two electrons being right on top of each other, which leads to a big interaction energy, is going to be zero. Okay, so what we're starting to do is to put together what are called Hund's rules. So Hund's rules, actually I have these on Xeroxes, so I can point at them there. Hund's rules were given to you, where? Here, I guess. Okay, so here we are, Hund's rules B in this case, that the quantum states with the aligned spin angular momentum, the largest possible value of S, is going to have the lowest possible energy. Okay, so Hund's rule C, we don't kind of, the helium doesn't provide us with enough examples of it to see it in action. But if we compare states that have the same value of spin, so if we compare triplet states, what it tells us is that the larger value of L will have the larger value of, excuse me, will have the lower value of energy. And the last rule has to do with the coupling together of L and S. So in general, of course, if we add L and S, we're going to get everything from L plus S to L minus S. And what it says is if the shell is half filled or less, then the smallest value of J will have the lowest energy. And if it's more than half filled, then the biggest value of J will have the biggest energy. Okay, so we'll come back to that in a second. Let me point quickly at something else, which I'm not going to make much reference to. How do we tell which states are connected by lines and which ones aren't connected by lines? The so-called allowed states. And these are the rules. And there's kind of a prior rule that's really more important, and that is that the L parity has to change. Basically, one of the electrons has to go from an even L to an odd L in order for the transition to be allowed. And then once we've done that, then we have these LS rules, that L is typically going to change by 0 plus minus 1. The spin isn't going to change, and that's what made that triplet state survive, right? Because the ground, the only lower state was a singlet state, and we were in a triplet state, so we couldn't go because there was a change in spin. So you notice that in all of those connecting lines for the helium atom, nothing connected, nothing went from this side to that side, right? That would be a state that changed spin. And here, for example, we have a case that is the change in L is 1, right? Because we're going from P to S. So notice that that's by far the most common situation. I'm not sure I see any cases shown here where we have a change in L of 1. Same thing applies here. Here we have a line where there's no change in L. Okay, so all I really want you to know is that not all transitions are equally likely, and that there are rules that tell you what transitions are allowed. And I'll never ask you to do it, but if you want to, you can look up what the allowed transitions are using these approximations. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the periodic table in the simplest possible sense, kind of in the sense of enterochemistry, and let's go into a little bit greater detail. So what we have is this sort of picture. Where I've used the L tilting to move what were degenerate states up because of this interaction with the cloud. And now it's just a matter of filling in these states with corresponding number of electrons. So if I have just one electron, I've got hydrogen, and I will denote that as 1s to the first power. I have one 1s electron. If I have helium, I can put one electron up and one electron down in that same state, and I can make something that is 2s. So the next thing up is going to be lithium. You can follow along on your periodic table. The next thing along is going to be lithium, and I can put one electron in the 2s state. And if I have another electron, it's going to go into that same state, so I'm going to have 2s squared. So if we work this all out, the final configuration of everything that's in one of these columns is going to be the same. It's going to be ending exactly the same as the previous one. And the fact that these outermost electrons, so-called valence electrons, are in the same relative state for a whole column is what makes it periodic chemical properties. So that lithium and sodium and potassium, these guys down here, all have pretty similar properties. Now, you might notice that hydrogen isn't a lot like sodium, and that helium isn't a lot like beryllium. Those are kind of special cases because the atoms are correspondingly light. And if you look at any chemical version of this periodic table, helium won't be put here. It'll be put with its chemical partners above neon, so-called closed shell cases. Okay, so this was lithium, this is beryllium, We add one more electron, and we've got boron, and it's going to go in the corresponding p state. Now, the p orbit has three different orientations, right? In general, m goes from minus l to plus l, so we have m values that are going to be minus 1, 0, and 1. Each one of those states can hold two electrons, so we can put a total of 6 electrons in this state. And what we're doing is we're working our way from boron to neon. So after neon, we've run out of n equals 2 states, and we start filling in n equals 3 states. And it's just a repetition of what we had before. Right? So sodium, magnesium, aluminum, all we're doing is adding the corresponding n value for S and the n value for P. So at argon, we have something interesting that's happening. So after argon, we don't go into the 3D level because it turns out it's been pushed above the 4S level. So following argon, we're going to have potassium that is going to, the next electron is going to go into the 4S level. And the alkali or earth calcium, it's going to go into the n equals 4 S level. And then we'll start to fill up this 3D. So D tells you L equals 2. So here we have M that can be minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2. Each one of those states can hold 2 electrons. So we have 2 times 5 or 10 slots to fill. And if you count the number of spots here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We have 10 spots to fill those D levels. After we fill these D levels, then we're going to fill the 4 P levels, making our gallium, germanium, arsenic, selenium, boron, krypton. Okay. So for N equals 4, we've got 4s, 4p, 4d, and 4f. And notice that the f states are also going to be delayed. We're going to only fill the n equals 4 f state when we're in the sixth row, the n equals 6 row. Okay, so there are a handful of exceptions, particularly for larger values of Z, which aren't going to concern us. Okay, so that's kind of the simple chemistry picture that gives us the electron configuration for any particular element. But it's missing lots of detail. So let's go through and take a look at boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and neon in a little bit greater detail. Okay, so for boron, what we've got is a filled 1s level, a filled 2s level, and we have 1p electron. So what do we have with 1p electron? So we have the total orbital angular momentum is going to be 1 from p, and the total spin is going to be 1/2 from the only spin we have, which is the 1 electron. So this is going to be a doublet p level. And this J value, it could either be 3/2 or 1/2. And we only have 1 electron in a shell that can hold 6 electrons. So the ground state is going to be p 1/2. Okay, so if you look in your book, they have a whole table of these. And you can confirm that we're getting the same answer that they're getting. Okay, so on to carbon. Well, carbon's going to be trickier, right? Because we have two units of angular momentum and we have two units of spin. So from the orbital angular momentum, we can make states that are 0, 1, or 2. And from the spin states, we can make states that are 0 and 1. We know that these triplet states are symmetric, and we know that the singlet state is antisymmetric. So they have to be paired with opposite symmetry states with orbital angular momentum. So the highest level state is always symmetric, and they alternate going down. So in terms of mixing and matching, we can make a state like that, that is triplet P. We can make a state like that, that is singlet D. And we can make a state like that, that is singlet S. And those are the only things we can make that are totally antisymmetric. So what one of these states is going to have the lowest energy? Well, so the first thing we do to look for lowest energy is we see which one's triplet, right? That's Hund's rule. The largest spin is the first thing to check. So the lowest energy is going to be triplet P. Comparing these two guys, the lower energy should be D, right? Because D is a bigger angular momentum than S. So we expect that these states are going to be singlet S, singlet D, and triplet P. Okay, so here's the energy level diagram of carbon. There they are. Triplet P is the lowest energy state, then D, then S. So one thing that is historical and therefore kind of crazy and doesn't make sense is this notation. So neutral carbon is labeled as C Roman numeral 1. Singly ionized oxygen is listed as oxygen Roman numeral 2. Roman numeral 3 oxygen is doubly positively charged oxygen. This is singularly charged, positively charged nitrogen. So one of the things that's crazy about this notation is it doesn't leave open something to write for negatively charged ions. Right? Oxygen can pick up an electron to make something that has one more electron than it has protons. This notation doesn't work for that at all. So historically, the positively charged ones were the ones that were discovered first. And so we had one oxygen spectra and we had another oxygen spectra, and they were naturally labeled 1 and 2, and then people eventually figured out that this was the ionized version of it. Okay, but if you take a look at oxygen 3, so if you take oxygen and you subtract two electrons from it, it's the same thing as carbon, right? And notice here we have exactly those same energy levels. And now we see that, in fact, the smallest value of J is the one that has the lowest energy of the P's. Okay, so these are famous nebular lines. These are all forbidden because, of course, there's no change in L, right? All of these are 2p electrons. So none of these jumps involved a change in L, and so they miss the dipole selection rule, but they are observed astronomically because they are in nebula that have walls that are light years away. So there isn't anything to bump into to lose your energy anyway by one of these very slow so-called forbidden processes. Okay, so boron, carbon, nitrogen. So this is going to be 2p cubed. So now we have kind of a mess, right? So we could add two of those L's together to get 0, 1, and 2, And then we could add 1 to each one of those to get 3, 2, 0, and 2, 1, 0, and 0, and 1. But who knows what the symmetries of those states are? Similarly, we could add together spin 1 half and spin 1 half to get singlet and triplet, and then we can add 1 half to those to get 1 half, 1 half, and 3 halves. But, you know, the symmetry of those states is not particularly obvious. But we could work it out, or we could have somebody else work it out for us. And what we have is someplace, a nice table that tells us what the allowed electrons are. So here it says terms with equivalent electrons. So these are all 2p electrons, and we have 3 of them. And so what it's saying is that the allowed states are doublet p, doublet d, and quartic s. Okay, so if we bothered to figure out what the symmetry of all of those states are, and they're going to have mixed symmetry in general, this is what we would have to have. This quartic S, you can kind of figure out what's going on with it, because of course this state that has spin 3 halves, that has to be a symmetric state where all of those states are spin up. And so it has to be paired with an anti-symmetric state. And the fully anti-symmetric state it's paired with is the Slater determinant of the 3 different p orbits that are possible, right? M equals 0, M equals plus 1, minus 1. So make a Slater determinant of those 3. You make a fully anti-symmetric function. It's going to be an S state. And of course, it's also going to be the ground state because it's the only one that has the biggest possible value of S. So the ground state is going to be quartic S. And in terms of spin, we're going to be adding spin 1 half, or spin 3 halves to spin 0. So the total spin angular momentum, the total angular momentum is going to be 3 halves. I don't know if I have an energy level diagram that confirms anything about nitrogen. Looks like I don't. Okay, so how about oxygen? So then we have 2p to the fourth. So first of all, there's a trick. And the trick is you can think about the absence of electrons, holes, as opposed to actual electrons. So this thing has 2 holes. The 2 holes should be kind of like carbon. So we should expect exactly those same states as we had with carbon. I don't know. Let's confirm that. So here we have 4p electrons, and look, it's exactly the same set of states for 4p electrons as it was for 2p electrons. So the ground state is going to be triplet p. The only thing that's new here is the J value. So this is a more than half full state. So the J value is going to be the sum. So this was triplet p, and that meant that the spin was equal to 1 and the angular momentum was equal to 1. So the total angular momentum is going to be the sum of those two. That's going to be the term. Okay, so once you know the trick of holes, notice that the, where are we? We're on fluorine. Fluorine is exactly the same as, I guess they didn't even bother to write what 1p was, but it's exactly the same thing as we had for 1p, right? We have a spin of 1 half from the 1 electron and, I'm pointing at the wrong thing. There. Spin a half of the electron, so it's going to give us doublet, and the hole is put in a p state, so it's going to be doublet p. Okay, and you can see things get even more complicated with these d states, but let's take a look at a d squared state. So that would be like this guy here, titanium. What's gonna be the story with it? So these, we got 2 n = 3 d states. The d tells us that this is angular momentum 2. So if we add 2 to 2, what we're going to get is everything between 3 and 4, right? Because they could be aligned or anti-aligned. This one has to be symmetric, anti-symmetric, symmetric, anti-symmetric, symmetric. If we add spin 1/2 to spin 1/2, we get singlet and triplet. Triplet is going to be the symmetric state, and then it's mismatch, right? So we could have triplet SPDFG, I guess. So this would be triplet F, and we could also have triplet P, and then we could have singlet states. We could have singlet G, singlet D, and singlet S. I don't know, did that, if I did it right, or the author did it right, these things should be the same. So we have triplet P's and F's, that's what I had, and then we have G, D's, and S's for the other angular momentum. Okay? So all of those states are going to exist as low energy states for the spectra of this element. But transitions between those states are going to be rare because no electron has changed its L value, right? Those are all D electron values. So it's much more complicated. Spectra of atoms, nuclei, particles, much more complicated than this simple picture that we've got. And so far, we've just been trying to figure out what the order of the states are, right? We really should be trying to figure out what the energy of these states are, period. So we could figure out what color of light, what photon is going to come out based on those energy differences. And that becomes, I don't know, increasingly complicated. So the baby steps that we had, I talked about, just using the orbits and calculating the expectation values of the Hamiltonian, that misses the splittings by a factor of 2, you know, which is a pretty big miss. So you have to do pretty sophisticated things to get, you know, 6 digits accurate on these transitions. Much computing power to do it right, which is not the purpose of this course. But we will do a better job than we've been doing when we get to the next chapter, which is on perturbation theory, methods of approximating. So we really have needed those methods of approximation in order to talk about the periodic table, but I tried to convince you about how it works without mathematical evidence behind me. So we'll provide the mathematical evidence in excruciating detail. But that's not what we're going to talk about next. What we're going to talk about next is cases where we have 6 × 10³ particles and what we can say about those cases. And in particular, solids. Lots of interesting technology built on silicon and exactly how those electrons move in that solid. Okay, so